here we are. It's 15 years. And
it certainly is. Oh, my goodness.
which frightens me a bit, because I remember actually watching it on the festival circuit back then. It was like the buzz about it was phenomenal.
Right.
But I mean, you talked a little bit yesterday during your panel about how weird and difficult it was dealing with the time. And I was wondering how much of it you had to really put that to one side and just say, you know what, I'm done with it. And how hard that was.
It wasn't hard at all, actually. I've always been a person that has enjoyed risk, actually. Like, so for me, the whole thought of doing Blair Witch, people were like, oh God, don't do it. You're going to go out into the woods for something you got out of backstage with a bunch of guys. That sounds like a snuff film. I would never do that. My mother's like, I want all their social security numbers. But I don't know. To me, I did that 100%. And then when I gave acting up and moved to the country to grow pot, I gave that 100%. And writing my book, I gave 100%. And now I'm developing a sitcom kind of based on the book, and then based on the whole now failure of the weed world, like that whole collapsing world, which I think is way funnier than that world being a lot of fun like it was 5 years ago. Yeah. The sense of impending doom I find hilarious. So now I'm giving that 100%. It's like every chapter has been so completely new that I've never had a hard time letting something go, because I know the next adventure is just around the corner.
Yeah. And I mean, going back to coming onto the project originally, I mean, how did they explain it to you? Because, you know, you watch it the first time and it's an art house horror film, and there's some sequences, particularly like the random shots of the foliage, which are so beautiful. And you take those out and you just go, it's just really pretty. And then it suddenly goes bleak, horrible, bad things happening. So, I mean, how do they explain a project like that to you?
Well, when they hired Joshua, he was a photographer who was shooting bands in New York. So they knew they would get some well-composed shots out of him as the alleged DP of the group. They just basically said that it was going to be a really uncomfortable shoot, that they would be concerned about our safety but not our comfort, and that it would be improvised. That was the thing that really appealed to me, because I was doing improv comedy at the time, and so I was like, wow, that sounds fascinating, to improvise an entire feature. Let's do it.
I mean, in a way, it's kind of a precursor. You know, everybody says, oh, you know, found footage came back. But you look at, you know, I know a bunch of the people involved in it, but the mumblecore scene, and they hate the word mumblecore. It drives Joe Swanberg absolutely nuts, because he's like,
so articulate.
Well, he always said it got the name because he couldn't afford good sound equipment in the early days, and that's like, oh, now I can. And people go, oh, you actually have a script and dialogue.
I think
like,
that's
no,
the whole found footage thing. I think Blair Witch showed people that they could make a movie with a very, very high profit margin. Or TV with a very, very high profit margin. I'm not sure that it's often an aesthetic decision so much as it is an economic one. And that you can create that limitation and work within it and come up with interesting creative things. But I think it became very clear after Blair Witch that it was a pretty good economic bet, the found footage.
Yeah. But not always an artistically safe one.
No.
I've seen,
it has certainly ceased to be inventive.
Yeah. I think you still can, but it's a lot tougher. And it has to be done in the editing room now. So much more.
A lot of Blair Witch was done in the editing room, for sure. I mean, the film was never intended to be our footage. We were only supposed to be 15 minutes of the movie.
I mean, does that make it worse when you were like, oh, originally we were supposed to be just part of it, and then it's the whole thing, and then you go, where's the check? Did that make the check
would have been awesome, yeah. That would have been great.
So did it make worse, like, now you're kind of like, you know, the whole shebang, and it's taking, you know, it's, you're not getting what you deserve from it?
Well, it certainly was a good prep. I mean, I was 24 when that came out, so I certainly learned a lot about the world from that experience. And it would have been, I think, kind of easy to become cynical, but I've kind of opted to continuously move on and not fall into that. Do you know what I mean? Like, I've always been part of some new world where I maintain hope that it will be less diabolical than the previous one I'm coming from.
How's that working out?
It's actually working out pretty good. I'm getting closer and closer to kind. the odd asshole thrown in for spice wherever I land. Yeah,
that's an inevitable part of the process.
It is an inevitable part. It's just human beings. What can you do?
So, I mean, you were talking about you're developing a sitcom. So, yeah. So what's the story there?
It's called Grass Valley, and I'm actually developing it with my ex that I write about in Grow Girl, and it's basically about a bunch of gentle-hearted outlaws in a crumbling world. Who are generally hypersexual and have a lot of cash flow. So that really creates a lot of opportunity for comedy.
Kind of a slower, more relaxed version of Breaking Bad.
A definitely more absurd and hilarious version. Breaking Bad-ish.
So, I mean, how did you get into the pod industry?
Well, because I wanted to get out of the entertainment industry, and I burned all my stuff in the desert, and then I went to a Vipassana retreat. I'm a long-term Vipassana meditator, and I had this thing of like, okay, whatever comes next is where my attention is going to go, and like I was truly just that open to whatever was going to happen, and this guy sat down next to me, and the guy that I'm now developing the sitcom with, and Matt Herman, and he said he lived in Grass Valley, and I said I loved it the first time I went there in 2000, right after Blair Witch, and I couldn't figure out what people did for a living up there, and he's like, well, I grow pot. And I was like, all right, congratulations, you just got an apprentice. And within a year I had 27 chickens, a new puppy, a ganja, indoor and outdoor ganja gardens, and I was off to the races.
So, I mean, as legalization has kind of increased...
it's disastrous for the town that I live in.
Oh, sure. No.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, no. Yeah. There's probably about 2 or 3 years left tops. And that's what's so funny about, like, now, like, one of our grower friends, a man, is considering becoming a midwife. Like, people are truly scrambling for, like, what are we going to do and how are we going to do it and stay in the town that we love? Like, how are we going to save our town? It's like, What are we going to do? Have a giant bake sale? You know, like, this town's been basically driven by this. It's in one industry town, like LA, except the industry happens to be only marginally legal.
It's the absolute reverse of, have you ever seen Polk County Pot Plane?
No.
It's this terrible exploitation film.
Uh-huh.
The town is basically going out of business because there's, the corn's not selling anymore.
Uh-huh.
And somebody, and they go, let's sell pot. And it's like, is this 1976? I saw Quentin Tarantino showed it one time in Austin.
I have got to write that down. I really want to see that. It's called Polk County.
Polk County Pot Plane. P-O-L-K. So.
I am definitely going to watch that. Wow. Yeah, it is like the opposite of that. Well, because, the pot business was it was kind of the last place for the American freedom-loving renegade. Now where do we all go? What's left? Now it's straight jobs for everyone. It's a comma tragedy that I hope to capture.
There's indie cinema, but that's even worse.
Oh, it's even worse these days. Yeah, that would have been great in like 95, but what are we all going to do now? And you don't get paid to write anymore. You can't write a book. Like, what's left? What's hipster apocalypse? Oh.
Well, I mean... start a tech startup and I think that and run off somebody else's money for years.
I refuse. No. Have you met? Do you know a lot of those guys?
Yeah. Yeah. It's even worse.
I used to be engaged to one. Let me tell you, that's not the answer.
Well,
that's a different horse of a different color altogether.
Yeah. Well, thanks very much. It's been a real pleasure.
Oh, God, no problem.
And hopefully, they turn that back on legalization and stuff gets good again.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, I think it's going to be like the wine industry. You know what I mean? There's always going to be room for boutique production. And I think it's going to be up to towns to rebrand themselves. Like, I feel like the town that I live in, if we can create those eco-lodges and embrace it. But the problem is a lot of those small towns are half very right-wing and half very progressive. And so there's always going to be this political battle of, like, we're not going to be able to have a dispensary showing the best of the county in downtown because the right-wing side is always going to put the kibosh on that. So it'll be a matter of really becoming more politically active locally.
You're not underground anymore, and therefore you don't appeal to the right. It's like, God damn you.
I can still make a very compelling case to libertarians for I mean, the case is super clear.
Well, there's word that Texas might legalize at least medical marijuana next year.
I don't see how you're going to really push against the zeitgeist much longer.
Yeah.
I mean, it's pretty... The writing is definitely on the wall. We all realize that, so...
Okay, so I'm here with Michael from Blair Witch Project.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you doing today?
Good.
So, I mean, I talked to Heather earlier, and it's been 15 years, which is so... It's so bizarre to think that, you know, this little kind of indie art house thing, which has kind of, you know, become a blessing and a curse for so many people involved, it's reached this age now. And I still think of it as, like, I remember when I first saw it, and I'm one of those people who was like, holy crap, this film is just, you know, the rule book just got thrown out. And, I mean, that's kind of a legacy to deal with. And I'm wondering how you personally have dealt with that, of knowing, like, this was so important, but... You know, as is the horrible story often with indie filmmaking, it doesn't necessarily work out as a good, happy ending for everybody involved.
Yeah, I would think it's interesting because it was obviously a good, I believe, a good independent film with something new, something that hadn't really been done before, that met success. It was just a tremendous amount of success that it met with, and it came so fast. As far as box office success, you wouldn't expect anything close to that for any independent film. And so what might have been a kind of a cool niche place for the film to live wasn't able to happen. It was a niche film that made more money than a mainstream film, so it became an anomaly. But I still consider it a blessing. You know, I'm no longer an actor, and I guess it's probably 4 or 5 years now, and it took me a long time to kind of come to that, and part of that was the success of Blair Witch. You know, I don't know that my life might have been different had I been in something that maybe made, you know, $8 million across the country as opposed to $240 million, but then I wouldn't have kind of a place in the history of filmmaking, which is kind of fun to have, you know,
yeah.
So... I look at it all as it's all good, you know. I have no, I really have no regrets over it, and you know, I have a very happy life, and I've chosen a different path, and I'm feeling fulfilled, and I got to have some fun with that time in my life when I was an actor. I did some cool stuff. I got to travel the world a little bit and shoot some films and meet some people, and so you know, it's hard to answer because you can't really change the course of time, but it is what it is, kind of a thing.
And I've talked to some of the actors who've had kind of a defining role very early in their career, and it haunts them. But then again, you know, how many people actually even get a defining defining role?
I mean, I know people who are still at it, 40, 45 years old, that haven't been able to break in, and they're working their butts off just to stay in the game. And I would feel badly to say, oh, geez, I wish this thing never happened, you know. I don't feel that way, but second of all, it's just unfair because people wait for these types of things to happen, especially when you're trying to be an actor or an artist, and you know, so.
When they, you know, when Ed and Daniel kind of first were explaining the project to you, because you look at it, and it's an art house horror, and it's not even a horror for most of it. It's an art house, middle of the wilderness,
sort of a dread film.
Yeah,
that's all it really, really.
Actually, that's the word I was talking to Robert Rodriguez a while ago, because he got Ed directing an episode of From Dusk Till Dawn, and he said that's what Ed does. He does dread,
yeah,
and really extraordinarily well. Right? He's not a horror director; he's a dread director.
Yeah,
and
interesting.
When he, you know, the how they explained that the project to you in the first instance. Of like what they were wanting from you and the tone they were kind of trying, because I think that, you know, as much as anything else, it was the tone that really resonated with audiences.
Interestingly enough, they never called it a horror film. You know, they never said we're going to do this horror film in the woods. They said we're going to do this film where you're going to be submerged into the circumstances, and we're going to do as our the best job we possibly can to get you living this experience where you're not sure what's kind of following you around the woods. You think there's something, you're not really sure. That was the idea, and it was all improvised, obviously. And my attraction to the project was those two things: the improv, the three things: the improv, the camping, and the experiment feel. And they kind of build it as an experimental film, and it was. It was completely experimental. So in that vein, we were sort of free to do whatever the hell we wanted. We're shooting on video. You could say what you want, do what you want, and they can cut it. I think there's probably 27 hours of footage that they whittled down to 80 minutes. So, you know, they set the tone in that way, just by saying, here's your world, you're going to live in it. Submerge yourself into it. And we did. And that's kind of where the tone came from.
And it was truly experimental in the way that, you know, even you look at something like Cannibal Holocaust, which is found footage, but they had cinematographers. I mean, they had the actors carrying camera for some of the time, but this really is, you know, you drop a, you know, you are the crew at the same time as being the performer. And I was just wondering about, you know, I mean, how much background you had even with the equipment of that.
No, I had to do the sound for the 16. I had a DAT, and I didn't know anything about sound. They brought us down a couple of days early to kind of train us on the equipment. And we were shooting around the D.C. area, so I went into D.C. for a couple of days with a real sound man, and he showed me what to do, and we just walked around using this kind of crash course in D.C., you know, sound machine thing. So I didn't know anything about it. I went to school for theater, for acting, and got a job as an actor, and they're like, and they sent me some kind of a, they sent me like a book on the DAT, like a how-to manual. I don't think I ever opened the book. I just waited till we got there and told them I read it. Because, you know, like anything, any equipment is, you really need to be using it to understand it. So it was, you know, it was limited experience. Josh with the camera, though, he knew cameras a little bit. So, you know, now he knows them very well. But back then he knew them a little bit. So for him to use that 16 was important. And a video camera anybody can use, obviously. That was the whole point. And the other thing is, back then, the only thing you ever saw on video was, you know, there was no YouTube or any of that stuff. Anything you saw on YouTube was your home videos. And they knew that, talk about tone, they knew that if you're in a theater watching somebody's home video, you can identify with that because you've seen them, you know, since the early 80s with your family. And so it becomes this sort of closeness that you have with it because it doesn't look like a movie. It looks like you're intruding into somebody's sort of claustrophobic. And I remember them saying that, like, it's going to look like, why are we watching somebody's home movies?
Yeah.
Interesting. And now, you know, a lot of stuff does that. But back then, nothing had done that before. So.
Only, you know, I've talked to a few people who've argued that it's kind of reshaped the culture in a very subtle way. And there was during the panel yesterday, somebody where, you know, it invented the selfie. But it really, you kind of got used to this idea of the camera as a ubiquitous presence, and it, you know, in a way that I think earlier found footage hadn't done. I think people got used to it and a lot of filmmakers were, well, I can do this to varying results.
Yeah.
And now everybody thinks they can do it because they have the equipment. And as somebody who watches a lot of films for my job, trust me, not everybody can do it.
The other thing is to have an authentic performance. Everybody can do it. Everybody can walk around and shoot whatever they want, but it's tough to kind of find that quality of work between what the director wants and what the actor is doing. And I'm sure if you look through the 27 hours of footage, you'd find 25 hours of crap, you know, and we were pretty decent actors. And I think the problem is not everybody can identify what a performance should look like when it's that kind of found footage stuff. It really needs to be natural, almost more so than your average tripod, you know, on sticks kind of film, in my opinion, really. Because of that home movie quality, because it's I'm watching my family on TV kind of quality, you know.
So I've always wondered, because I know there were various different edits, and the, you know, the original Brooklyn edit was long, and then Sundance. I've got a friend who's got a copy of the Sundance edit that he was sending a screener at the time. So I mean, you know, when you guys were watching it progress, you know, how were you feeling about, okay, here's the edit, now it's how it's different, and it, you know, was it what you thought it was going to be when
I
you first walked
the,
in?
The edit that we saw in Manhattan, maybe in 1998, was too long, didn't really work. It was kind of rough. I didn't think it was ready for an audience, and they did invite an audience. And it was kind of like, oh, this isn't really going to go anywhere. And then I had obviously nothing to do with the edit, so the next edit I saw was in Sundance. I went, how the hell did that film get into Sundance? And when I went into Sundance, there was something about those screenings that was like very, you know, like palpable. It was exciting, and it worked, and it was shorter, and whatever they, I don't know what they cut out, but it just made more sense. It was a nice trim, kind of, it moved better,
yeah.
And so that's really the only two cuts I had seen.
And it's kind of almost what happened with Paranormal Activity, because that sat on the shelf for I think 3 years.
Oh, I didn't
and
there
was know like, that. I think there's like, I want to say 7 or 8 different endings because they just didn't know how to bring it into land. And it finally, Jason Blum, who produced it, released it through Blumhouse, the popular thinking is that he almost took it on as a bet because they were like, well, we spent $150,000 acquiring this.
Yeah.
It's nothing. How do we do a release on it? And so he was the one who really pioneered the, you know, if you demand it, we will bring it model.
Yeah, right.
And it, you know, and in the same way that, and it's kind of like the format and the release was revolutionary in the same way that the format and the release of Blair Witch was revolutionary. So it's like this, it's almost like there's a 10-year cycle that every 10 years somebody's going to come up with something that really kind of kicks the industry in the ass and
right.
goes, oh, hang on, no, you can't get dull.
And now you have DVD and theatrical at the same time.
Yeah.
I don't know how well that's working, but let's talk about revolutionary. You know, more people are watching films at home than ever before.
Yeah.
Because we have such good equipment now and affordable equipment. But I certainly hope that the movie theaters stay. It's sort of a cultural staple for our country, and I don't want to see them go away, you know?
Yeah.
This Alamo Draft House, to me, is now revolutionary. You know, I brought my kids to see the Lego Movie and had a beer and a burger while we're watching this thing. Yeah, it's a great experience. You know,
it's an Austin creation, the Alamo Draft House.
Yes,
I went to the I used to go to the original on Colorado, and just like
this is that over in Yonkers in New York.
Yeah.
You know,
Tim Leake's very happy that he's got a footprint there.
He's
like, I'm in New York now, bitches. You can't stop me.
Yeah, good.
So one thing I've always wondered about. I mean, I know it's, you know, you talked yesterday that you guys on the cast kind of stayed in contact a bit on and off over the years. You know, do you guys ever keep in contact with Ed and Daniel?
Well,
I know Ed, again, has...
Ed and I made a spoof of the Blair Witch called Four Corners of Fear. So all you guys out there, if you could check it out on Facebook. We did it a few years ago, and we just kind of put it out. It's a bunch of little webisodes where basically it's Josh, myself, Ed, and... Tom Cruise, actually. Obviously a joke, but that's the whole premise, is what if we did Blair Witch sequel with Tom Cruise? And we have this actor, Evan Ferrante, who does an amazing Cruise impersonation. Tom Cruise even likes his impersonation. And it's just sort of this silly webisodes. They're about 4 or 5 minutes each. They're about 10 minutes. There are about 10 of them. And if you could check it out on Facebook, that would be great. But anyway, Ed and I are very close, and I do keep in contact with him.
He's really... People have started, I think, to realize just how good a director he was.
Yes, he's got Intruders now, and he's got Exists coming up.
Which is phenomenal. I saw that.
I'm dying to see it.
Oh, it's so good.
Yeah, South by Southwest.
Yeah, I saw it. In fact, he was really upset. I had a phone interview, and he was like, I had to miss it. I wasn't at my own premiere because I was shooting something else.
Yeah, because he's shooting in Vancouver.
Yeah, so
he was supposed to be here, actually, and he couldn't make it. I was hoping to see him. I haven't been in contact with Dan as much. I mean, we're all Facebook friends, but that's most of my contact with Dan. Talk about another talented director. I did a film called The Objective with him. I was fortunate. They both hired me for their sophomore films. Ed hired me for Altered. Dan hired me for The Objective. And they're just, you know, the world will figure out sooner or later that both of these guys are just very talented. I don't think they got enough credit. I don't think anybody really got enough credit for the film. I mean, obviously, it's hard to say that when you know that the film did so super well, but then it was like, well, what did you guys actually do? And that was the question for everybody. As a director, well, what did you actually do if you weren't in the woods with them? As an actor, well, were you really acting? You know, I mean, it's just like, well, somebody made this damn movie, you know? So, just a talented group and good people, you know, genuinely good people, which is, you know... Sometimes kind of rare.
It's a surprising rarity in the film industry.
Yeah.
okay, so here I am with Joshua now, having worked my way down the line. So, one question that's come up all weekend is, obviously you guys had an incredibly complicated relationship with Blair Witch. So, and like 15 years on now, you guys seem to be coming back and actually talking about it, you know, in public and doing things like this. So, I mean, what was the moment where you went, this is time to probably embrace it a little bit more?
I don't know. I don't want to speak for everybody. There's always been a side of me that's embraced the movie. It's certainly far less complicated now than it used to be. But you know, very much like anything that's a big event in your life, it comes to signify many different facets of. You know, that time period of your life. I think, I don't know, you know that time when you're out of your parents' house for 20 years and all of a sudden you go home and you're like, I should stop getting pissed off at my parents for those same things that I got pissed off at them for when I was a teenager, because I'm completely my own man and they have actually no power over me anymore. I think much the same with Blair Witch. There's you know, not only is there no power, there's no residual power left. It's just, it's a contributing factor to my life and a movie that I'm proud of, and one that, unless I choose to put myself in a situation where there's a lot of Blair Witch fans, for example, a horror convention, not even something that really comes up on a day-to-day basis in my life anymore. And I've been fortunate enough to keep working enough, since we made the movies that I think I had the luxury of paying attention to it a lot less because I was just focused on the job at hand.
Yeah. Well, it's that strange balance that, you know, you've got a role that people know you for very, you know, basically straight out the gate, and a film that they know you for, and they're like, you know, but then you don't want to just be known for that. So, I mean, how is that curve? Of not just being the Blair Witch guy in your career.
Well, I think it's bifold. I think it's reality and perceptional. In reality, Blair Witch is probably 1/100th of the work that I've done and roles that I've played. So in terms of real estate of my life spent doing something and dealing with something, Blair Witch is very small. There's still a lot more people who want to talk to me about Blair Witch when I'm in a press situation. So in terms of public perception, it's still the best known thing that I've done. It's the most profitable movie that I've made. So it comes up a lot in these situations. But in my day-to-day life, it's just one small piece of a larger picture.
It's like Joe Swanberg, who said, you know, people still ask me about getting my cock out in films, and I haven't done that in years. Mainly because my wife won't let me anymore. But you know,
but it's, oh my God, I watched that whole Young American Body series. Yeah, yeah. Put a lot of cocks in that.
It's very, very penis-y.
Yeah.
And Joe's starting to experiment with horror stuff now at the moment as well.
Yeah, which, yeah, and he and Ty just did Sacrament together.
Which is phenomenal.
I haven't seen it yet.
Oh, it's...
I haven't seen it yet. I was just talking to Joe. Joe's in L.A. making a movie right now.
Of course he is.
Yeah.
It's Joe. When's Joe not making... Joe farts and he's made a film. I mean, like, the guy's ridiculously...
He's very prolific.
He's... And it was fun when he put out Drinking Buddies, because suddenly people were going, he can do a real film with real actors. And we're like, yes... We all knew this for years. How are you guys not paying attention? And now Anna Kendrick is just completely like, I will work with Joe and whatever. Knowing, because I also know Adam Green vaguely, more miserable at shooting experiences. Hatchet! Or Blair Witch.
Here's the thing about making a horror film. You sit down with people at a restaurant before the movie starts and you're like, that's an awesome person. This is going to be so much fun because you're working with these great people. And then you get there and 9 times out of 10, you're shooting somewhere in the middle of the night because most horror films take place mostly in the dark. You're covered in corn syrup and you're getting faux beaten on, which means you normally get some bumps and scratches on you. It's never, I would say it's never particularly fun making horror film. Bitter Feast, I remember, because I loved Larry Fessenden and James LeGros.
Who doesn't love Larry? Larry's just crazy talented.
You know, and we were all talking about the movie beforehand. I was like, it's going to be like an indie horror film. It'll be like smart dudes. It'll be so much fun. And then you get there, and they put the chains around your neck, and they put the corn syrup on your face. And you're like, oh, yeah, I remember. This isn't the most fun thing to do. But yeah, I mean, Adam's fantastic. He's a true horror fan. He's a great dude. Yeah. He's just, you know, he's the nicest guy in the world. And he's one of those guys who on set, his enthusiasm is infectious.
Yeah. He actually was doing him and Joe Lynch came down to Austin and they did a kind of a screener publicity thing for Holliston and also show a little bit of Knights of Bad Aston. It's just, God, 2-3 years ago now. And they were coming down anyway, and somebody mentioned that there was a local charity needed a fundraiser. And we were like, oh, we'll do it as a fundraiser. And there was like, no question. It's like, we'll do it as a fundraiser. We'll just cover all our own costs, everything. It was like, and they were giving away stuff left, right, and center just to get people through the door. So yeah, they're just the most ridiculously nice guys.
Yeah, it's funny, a good dude.
You mentioned Larry, Larry Fessenden. He's one of these people I think people are starting to realize how good he is as a director, and you know, and Ed Sanchez.
Fessenden, I actually worked with as a producer. He produced Bitter Feast, but yes, also I'm well
just generally as a filmmaker. Yeah. I think people are suddenly going, he's really good. He's a good writer as well. It's like it's starting to like get that recognition. But you know, in Ed and Daniel, I think it took a long while for people to realize like how good they were as directors as well. I just noticed, and you know, Ed, it's just happening now. People realize like, holy shit, Lovely Molly's amazing and stuff like that. So I was just wondering, like, you know, after the film, after which, like, you know, did you ever keep in contact with those guys? Because, you know, they had their trouble. You know, it wasn't like they got all the money and suddenly were like, yay, we're big directors. They had a lot of trouble.
Yeah, no, I think one of the things that we talked about at the panel yesterday was the fact that the movie, in terms of its reception, in terms of its aesthetic at the time and in terms of its public reception, was such an anomaly that that I think very little credit went to the creative team, ultimately, because it just seemed like a shit accident. And I think a big part of it was that. But also, if the film hadn't worked, it also wouldn't have become what it was. So I think it was very much a combination of right time, right place with the right film.
What's the old line that a successful film and a good film is basically what that miracle that happens somewhere between finishing the script and striking the print. And mm-hmm. It's like something happens there, and if you can wrangle it the right way, then you get a good film. But it's, you know, it does take people wrangling it. And I don't think, you know, like I said, people didn't get the credit for it. And that's, you know, I think they are now. And I think, as much as anything else, people have stopped going, all bad found footage movies, all improv movies are the fault of Blair Witch. And I think in some ways, like Blair Witch now, people look back on and say, yeah, you could do an improvised film. And, like, it was legitimate to do that in something other than just a pure art house environment. I think that's helped a lot of directors.
Oh, sure. But it also wasn't it wasn't a subgenre at that point. You know, and we used the aesthetic out of necessity, out of budgetary constraint. But I do think I think especially at that time, because it was so left of center from what people were making, we still get, I sit at this table and I get the question, or I get people all the time saying, I thought it was real. That's partially because of the marketing campaign, and it's partially because of, you know, the aesthetic of the movie and the actors that Ed and Dan cast, that we look like real people, that we talk like real people, that we improvised the film. So I think it was never really perceived under the rubric of craft more. People still think it was more inadvertent than anything, that it came together the way it did.
Yeah, and improv is as hard as anything else, not least because it's actually like, it's like rehearsing, but having the director there going, no, wrong, stupid.
Well, and you're also using half a writer brain when you're improvising, because, you know, as Duplass always says, bad improv is sitting around talking about the chocolate bananas.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, you're like, if this is abstract enough, it'll seem real. Whereas what we really watch in the film is the propulsion of, you know, propulsion of conflict and story. So when you're improvising entirely, there really does have to be half an eye on making sure the story moves forward, and not that you're just having, you know, a completely boring but naturalistic moment of verisimilitude on, you know, being captured by a camera.